make sure to give my dad a 5-star review.
Make sure to like and subscribe to his YouTube. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
But as it turns out, Newton spent more time during his life studying alchemy than physics. And the only reason you never hear about it is because today we consider alchemy to be a pseudoscience. So, you know, all that time was wasted because it didn't work out.
Right.
But it could have easily gone the other way around. I mean, as far as Newton is concerned, Newton himself apparently thought that alchemy was more important than physics because he spent more time doing the first one rather than the latter. So oftentimes, the difference between science and pseudoscience only comes up later.
Hello, Faithful Politics listeners and watchers now on YouTube. This is Josh Bertram, your faithful co-host. Will is currently figuring out his gubernatorial campaign for Virginia in 2025. And I'm totally kidding, but that's where he's at. And he is, so he won't be with us today. But we do have with us today a professor of philosophy, Massimo Pigliucci. Thank you for being with us today, Massimo.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So Professor Pigliucci is the K.D. Irani Professor of Philosophy at the City University of New York. He holds a Ph.D. in evolutionary biology from the University of Connecticut and a Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which has recognized him for his major contributions to the studies of gene-environment interactions and his educational efforts to counter widespread pseudoscientific beliefs, which we'll get into as we talk. He's published more than 170 peer-reviewed papers and authored edited 14 books, including Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk, and The Philosophy of Pseudoscience, Reconsidering the Demarcation Problem. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, has been interviewed by PBS, BBC World Service, NBC News, the Boston Globe, the Guardian, the Atlantic, Newsweek, The Economist, Forbes, Wired, and Scientific America, and even made a guest appearance on the Colbert Report. He has a podcast called Stoic Meditations, and his writings and musings can be found at Massimo Pigliucci, but it's P-I-G, the G is silent, L-I-U-C-C-I.com. Well, that was a mouthful, Massimo. I feel like I should I don't know, be bowing down to you or paying homage to you, or maybe as the ancient Romans did, you know, putting some incense or spice into
better
the
not.
Altar.
I better not.
As a pastor, huh? I don't think that would be.
Yeah, that would not be appropriate. No, that's right.
Well, Massimo, tell me a little bit about your, I mean, I read that, but what about your history? How did you get into philosophy? How did you get into biology? How did all this come together?
Well, I started my academic career as a biologist, as an evolutionary biologist, to be precise. And that was because I always had an interest in becoming a scientist since I was a kid, and since I can't remember, in fact. And so I pursued, the standard academic career, undergraduate, then doctoral studies, and then a postdoc, and then a position as a full-time faculty at the University of Tennessee. And that went on for a good amount of time, and I was doing my research and being happy, funded by the National Science Foundation with my students, postdocs, and all that sort of stuff. But then at some point I thought, all right, this has been fun so far for the last, 20 years or so, but do I really want to keep doing the same things for another 20 or 30 or whatever it is? And the answer was, no, not really. Now, this is not an unusual thing, actually. A lot of academics arrive at their mid career and then start asking themselves, what else can I do? Now, what was different in my case is that normally, let's say a scientist in biology like myself would have looked into similar fields nearby. So instead of evolutionary biology, maybe ecology, maybe molecular biology,
right,
or something like that, right? In my case, I decided to just jump completely on the other side of campus, basically going to the humanities side and
the soft sciences, right?
the so-called soft disciplines. And I enrolled in a PhD program in philosophy. And in fact, I had a friend of mine, Jonathan Kaplan, who is a philosopher of science, as my mentor there. And that's because I also had a long time interest in philosophy, which I developed when I was in high school. I grew up in Italy. And in Italy, you had to take 3 years of philosophy in high school. And my teacher at the time was wonderful. So she really made the subject matter come alive. And even though I hadn't pursued that professionally, I still had an interest in philosophy for a long time. So I managed to combine my two interests in philosophy on the one hand and science on the other hand by doing philosophy of science. And philosophy of science basically is a field that looks at science a little bit from the outside in the way in which, let's say, a historian of science looks at science from the outside or a sociologist of science looks at science from the outside. So philosophers ask themselves what exactly it is that scientists are doing, how they do it. Could they do it better? Sometimes, that's the case. So it's also a way to look at science critically from the outside and say, well, you know, certain things work very well, other things don't work very well. When I was in Tennessee, while during my time in Tennessee, I also inevitably, I guess, got involved into issues of what is called the demarcation between science and pseudoscience. You know, where is exactly this boundary between the two? And the reason for that is because, of course, as an evolutionary biologist, I was challenged by a lot of people who were creationists. Right. And I started.
Us so creationists, man.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's Knoxville, Tennessee, which was only 30 or 40 miles from Dayton, Tennessee, which is was the site of the Scopes trial in 1925, the first trial about the teaching of evolution. So I got involved into that, and so I started writing and giving public lectures about the nature of science and the difference between science and pseudoscience. And when I moved to philosophy, that also came in handy because part of my interest in philosophy is, in fact, what philosophers call the demarcation problem. And the demarcation problem actually goes all the way back to Socrates. You know, right at the beginning of Western philosophy, there is a delightful dialogue by Plato called the Charmides, where Socrates asks himself, so how do we tell the difference between a doctor and a quack?
Right.
How do I know that I'm going to this guy and he actually knows what he's talking about? And his conclusion is pretty pessimistic. He says, you know, unless I myself become a doctor, I can't tell the difference. Hmm. And so it's interesting that people have been talking about how to tell the difference between, you know, reasonable science, good science, and something that is not so reasonable, so good for literally 2.5 millennia.
That's amazing. So what are the kind of questions? I mean, you kind of alluded to it when you're talking about philosophy of science, but when you're going through your two different, you know, trajectories of evolutionary biology and then the philosophy of science, what was the most striking difference in terms of the questions that you asked in a scientific investigation versus a philosophical investigation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, when I was an active biologist, my field of interest was gene-environment interactions or nature-nurture issues. So I studied plants, but this can be applied to animals, human beings, whatever. And I wanted to figure out exactly how genes and environments interact to yield what we look at as a living organism. And, it's the kind of research you do via a combination of fieldwork, laboratory experiments, systematic observations, that sort of stuff. When I moved to philosophy, one of my questions, my overarching questions was, how does the field of evolutionary biology itself, the theory, the fundamental theory that underlies the field of evolutionary biology, how does that evolve over time?
Hmm.
So, Darwin published his famous book on the origin of species in 1859. Now, we are a considerable amount of time later, and the theory has been modified significantly. You know, no modern biologist simply signed up on what Darwin wrote more than a century and a half, almost 2 centuries ago. And so one of the questions as a philosopher was, well, how did that change? How many iterations can we identify of the theory of evolution? How did that happen conceptually? How did the ideas change over time, and why? Why is it that modern evolutionary theory is different, more complex, and in some cases even rejects some of the notions that Darwin presented in his book? So It's a little bit of a mix of history of science, because you have to understand the history before you realize, right, or figure out why certain things happen. But also is a question of conceptual change. You ask yourself, how do evolutionary biologists justify what they say, in their textbooks? How do they justify their work? On what basis do they actually change their mind or not change their mind about things?
So if I'm understanding correctly, so we have the, science as a, the scientific investigation is trying to answer questions, but it's answering questions maybe based on a set of assumptions about maybe how the world works. And that's been informed by the history of scientists that have come before, and even the philosophy of their own age. And philosophy tries to take a step out and look at it and say, okay, how, I see that you get this data, but what are your assumptions, and how, on what basis do you make those assumptions?
That's exactly right. It's kind of as you say, it's a step back, and it looks at the foundation of scientific research. And, it's not a question that scientists are naive and, they use assumptions without understanding it. They have to do it. They have to assume a number of things. Otherwise, they don't get anything done.
Yes.
But at the same time, there is also an interest in asking, well, where do these assumptions come from? Do they stand up to scrutiny, and so on and so forth? Let me give you an analogy. Let's say that you are presented with a practical problem. Let's say fixing a car, right? Well, it's not like every time you fix a car, you go back and revisit the theory of combustion engine. It's like,
yes,
you just take it for granted that certain things work.
You're a practitioner.
In a certain way. Yeah, you're a practitioner. You take for granted certain things, and you go back to them only exclusively if things really don't work and you have no idea of why they don't work. Then you might start questioning some of your assumptions. But it is interesting for somebody else to look at, who doesn't actually have to bother fixing cars, to look at it from the outside and say, well, isn't that interesting that these people are using, certain notions about physics and engines and not other notions that they could equally use?
Oh, that makes so much sense to me, and I have a lot of interest at an amateur level in science and in philosophy of science. And when you talk about science versus pseudoscience, especially, I'm especially interested because of how in your time, especially living there in Knoxville, it was some of this clash with creationists at time that almost like brought this question out to you that you felt like you needed to research and understand. So what is the difference between science and pseudoscience? When people throw that word around, that's pseudoscientific, that's not really show me how you did it. But what is that, the nature of the demarcation problem, and what do you think is the difference between science and pseudoscience?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, Josh Bertram here, faithful host of the Faithful Politics Podcast. I want to let you know about a compelling new spinoff, the Faith Roundtable, where I'll be interviewing top faith leaders, theologians, and scholars to unpack the pressing issues that are shaping the church in America today. We'll dive into topics like faith in public life, social justice, and how we can engage our communities more effectively. Make sure you don't miss any of our enlightening conversations by subscribing to it on our YouTube channel. Join me at the Faith Roundtable, where deep discussion meets thoughtful insight.
That's an excellent question. So for a long time, philosophers thought that there was a pretty sharp demarcation between the two, that, it's pretty clear what is science and it's pretty clear what is pseudoscience. But when they actually started trying to articulate what kind of criteria you could actually use to separate the two, it turns out that no single criterion or even no small set of criteria was actually going to do the job, because you would always have some disciplines that look like a little bit more on the pseudoscience part, but they could become, cross on the other side and vice versa. And in fact, historically, that has been the case. Like, for instance, think about Isaac Newton, right? We think of him today as a physicist, although, of course, at the time he was a philosopher because physics didn't exist as a field. You know, science didn't exist as a field, but he considered himself a natural philosopher. Now, we think of him as a physicist because, of course, his theory of gravitation was very successful. His mechanic physical mechanics was very successful. But as it turns out, Newton spent more time during his life studying alchemy than physics. And the only reason you never hear about it is because today we consider alchemy to be a pseudoscience. So, you know, all that time was wasted because it didn't work out.
Right.
But it could have easily gone the other way around. I mean, as far as Newton is concerned, in fact, Newton himself apparently thought that alchemy was more important than physics because he spent more time doing the first one rather than the latter. So oftentimes, the difference between science and pseudoscience only comes up later in time. You know, you can't necessarily tell at the moment, you just have to wait and see what pans out. For instance, let me give you an example on the other side. You may remember that a few years ago, there was this brouhaha in the physics and chemistry community about these people who allegedly had figured out a way to have cold fusion. So to have a physical process of fusion of atoms done at room temperature with chemical means instead of, you know, in big accelerators or in big machines. Well, that would have been spectacular had it worked, right? This would have made a huge difference not only to the theory of physics and to our understanding of the world, but also in terms of, practical applications like producing energy. It would have been far cheaper to produce energy that way, for instance. So for about a year or so or two, that was all the rage with papers published in major scientific journals. But then people started trying to replicate the experiments in other laboratories, and they failed. They couldn't replicate them. And then they started looking more carefully at the protocol that the original authors had used, and they tried to repeat the experiment exactly in the way it was done, and it didn't come out. Now, at some point, the scientific community, the physics community said, okay, this thing actually doesn't work. Well, what happened then was interesting. A group of diehard supporters of cold fusion started organizing its own meetings separate from the rest of the physics community. It started publishing its own papers in its own journals, doing its own peer review and all that sort of stuff. So basically, very quickly, we saw the evolution literally under our eyes over a matter of a few years, the evolution of a pseudoscience. Today, cold fusion is a pseudoscience, considered a pseudoscience. But it wasn't like 20 years ago. When it came out, it was like, okay, this sounds interesting. So it can easily go one way or the other. And again, we need to sort of wait and see how things develop. Now, the case of cold fusion gives you a good hint at how you can attempt a demarcation and what is the nature of pseudoscience. The community of people that believe in cold fusion basically now believes in something that has been, in fact, demonstrated to be false. It's, you know, it's pretty clear to the scientific community in general that this thing doesn't work. But they pretend that it works, and they mimic science. They have, as I said, their own journal, their own conferences, their own et cetera. So that's a pretty good definition of a pseudoscience, something that pretends to be scientific, something that pretends to work in the same way in which science does, but in fact, it doesn't work. In fact, we have pretty good evidence that it doesn't work. Now, there are plenty of other examples throughout the history of science and pseudoscience, one of which is astrology. So today, astrology is pretty much universally considered pseudoscience, well, except by astrologers, of course.
Right.
But, you know, if you go back 2,000 years to Ptolemy, the guy that actually came up with one of the first models of the structure of the solar system, well, he was an astronomer just as much as an astrologer. He drew no difference whatsoever between the two. For him, they were the same exact thing.
They were the same thing.
But again, we remember him today as an astronomer because that part worked out.
Right.
But not as an astrologer because that one didn't work out, didn't pan out.
That's so fascinating to me. And of course, as a Christian, as a pastor, my question goes to, you know, and we'll get into some of the political aspects of this, but my because that, the political and the religious are very closely tied, as you can see, and especially in voting habits in our country and everything. And that's been the way for millennia, I think, you know, in terms of politics and religion. But if we're thinking about, like, let's say creationism, okay, which has, when you're talking about the cold fusion, you know, creationism, the Discovery Institute, they have their own maybe journals, they're peer reviewed, they have people that with PhDs that have been on it. So what is it? So it's like, what distinguishes, say, creationism and the scientific, or in your view, pseudoscientific pursuits of, say, creationists and their academics, creationist academics, versus, say, the more like renowned and well-known scientific theories and scientific, you know, publications and that kind of.
Well, here's one difference. I know actually a number of people at the Discovery Institute. I've talked to them over the years. I've actually, or occasionally even, we had, you know, panel discussions or debates together. And here's one different, one interesting observation. Every single person that is associated with the Discovery Institute is a Christian, usually an evangelical Christian.
Mm.
Every single one of them. On the other hand, if you sample the scientific community at large, worldwide, you find Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, atheists, agnostic. It doesn't matter. That tells you something. It tells you that on the one side you have a pretty clear ideological bias, while on the other side you don't. You know, I know that the people at Discovery Institute love to present evolution as an atheistic notion, but it isn't. I have a lot of colleagues in biology departments who are not atheists and who recoil from the whole notion of atheism, and nevertheless, they're evolutionary biologists. So right there is an interesting difference between the two. But the other, I think, more important, more substantial difference is that the overwhelming consensus within biology is that evolutionary theory is broadly correct, or at least approximately correct. And equally, there is a very broad consensus that creationism isn't anything that you can build on. I mean, you cannot use the notion of intelligent design to actually discover new things in biology, to actually bring forth a research program in biology. And that is why it's considered a pseudoscience, because it doesn't lead anywhere. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't produce anything other than, of course, the reinforcement of a particular ideological, religious, mindset. Now, people often tell me, yeah, but wait a minute, the experts sometimes are wrong. Sure. Of course they are.
Sure.
We're all human beings, right? but let me ask you a question, not you personally, but, you know, ask these hypothetical interlocutor a question in return. It's like, so if not to the expert, where you want to go to get some answers, right? So let me go back to my example earlier on of, you know, you have a car, and let's say that your car breaks down. Where are you going to bring your car? Not to the preacher, not to the dentist, you know. You're going to bring it to a mechanic. Why?
Right.
Because the mechanic is an expert. Now, does that mean that the mechanic is going to always be able to solve the problem with your car? No. Because he's a human being. So sometimes he's not going to get it. Sometimes the problem might not be solvable at all. So if the mechanic doesn't solve the problem, what do you do now? Now you go to the dentist or the preacher? No, you go to another mechanic, right? And eventually, if no mechanic can solve the problem, you're just going to junk the car and get a new one, right? So in terms of sheer common sense, that's the way we work in day-to-day life. We go to the expert community or an expert within that community, and we say, hey, can you fix this thing? Or can you tell me how this thing works? We do not assume that the experts are infallible, nor do we assume that we're always going to get a satisfying answer to the question. We simply assume that our best bet by far is to go to the expert or the community of experts. That applies to science as well. Science in that sense is no different from, you know, if you have a problem in your car, you go to the mechanic. If you have a problem in your teeth, you go to the dentist, and so on and so forth. And if you have a problem with your faith, you go to the preacher.
Right.
Right. Again, you're not going to go to the mechanic and say, hey, I have a problem here, an issue. You know, I don't understand the Trinity. Can you explain it to me? It's like, no, you're going to your preacher or your priest. So one of the things that really baffles me is that nobody would disagree with the kind of scenario that I just presented you. And yet a large number of Americans seem to have a problem with scientific expertise as opposed to any other kind of expertise. We have no problem whatsoever with other kinds of experts, but somehow when it comes to science, we kind of pick and choose. I would like to add that it's not that Americans have a problem with science in general. They only have a problem with science when it conflicts with certain ideological positions. Right, because the very same people that deny evolution, let's say, or climate change, then those very same people are attached to their iPhone, and depend for their lives on their iPhone, which means that they trust science.
Yes, right?
Because that's a scientific product. That's a technological product. So they go to the doctors. They might not go and get vaccinated for COVID because they might have certain strange ideas about COVID vaccines, but they do go to their doctor otherwise, right?
Yes.
If they have anything from a flu to cancer, they're going to go to their doctor.
Yes.
So it's kind of a pick and choose. That would be like, I'm going to my mechanic, but only if the problem doesn't concern the brakes. If it concerns the brakes, then I'm going to go to the preacher. It's like, what? No. That doesn't make any sense.
No, I really understand what you're saying. So what I want to just return to Christian for a second, just to make sure I'm getting my mind around what you're saying, is that so it's not the creationism as a theory, as a workable, operational theory, that it's what you're saying is the structure of that theory does not enable it to make scientific progress, whereas and some of the issues that we see are, number one, a very clear bias towards one particular belief system and group of people, and at the same time whereas evolutionary theory would span all sorts of different belief systems.
Correct. And it can be used to actually discover new things. It has been used to discover new things over the last...
It has been used to discover new things. And so that makes sense. So then what we're seeing then is that this theory of creationism, and this can kind of segue us into the interaction of our beliefs, our actions, like, for instance, we talked about the COVID vaccine, which is a very, very, you know, very clear and very... what's the word I'm looking for? Very profound issue that we're facing right now, which gives us, like, it materializes this conversation.
Right,
that's not the right word, but anyway,
it makes it very concrete. Yeah, it makes it very concrete because
it concretizes. That's a better way.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about so we have this theory that works. And it's based on, you know, it's been replicated, it's been used with great success in terms of, say, the evolutionary theory, and the scientific method used with great success to make advancements, to understand knowledge. This spans all sorts of different ideologies. So what we're saying is that the creationism theory is more of a ideology than it is a scientific method.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay. So how do you, so what do we do when, in terms of, like, all these different belief systems that are using science, those are just two different types of questions, scientific questions versus metaphysical questions?
Yeah. Well, if you're talking about metaphysical questions, then of course there is a whole different discipline that deals with those questions, and that's philosophy.
Yeah,
right.
Philosophical questions. Yeah.
Right. So I would, if we're talking again, it comes down to who are the experts here? Who is the relevant community of people that actually worked on these things? Now, if you were to go, if you're interested in, let's say, in the problem of free will, which is a metaphysical issue.
Right.
I wouldn't go to a scientist to ask them, you know, what do you think of free will? It's like, I don't know. you cannot do experiments on free will. There are people actually that claim that they do, but it turns out they don't. There are some neuroscientists who have made claims and on those in that direction. But as it turns out, I just read a really interesting article just a few weeks ago that says, no, not really. It's neuroscience doesn't really have a lot to do with free will. So if you're interested in free will, or if you're interested in questions of meaning, for instance, then I would say, don't go to a scientist, go to somebody who has actually spent their lives thinking about free will. That would be a metaphysician. You know, metaphysics is a branch of philosophy. If you're right. interested in questions on meaning, you might want to go to an ethicist, to somebody who studies those questions. And there too, you will find the exact same variety from an ideological perspective, right?
Right.
I know metaphysicians who are Christians, Jews, Muslims, atheists, and so on and so forth. And the same goes for ethicists. And there, it means that the community does not have a bias. Individuals will, right? Because you might talk to an individual ethicist who happens to be a Christian, and he will give you a particular view of things.
Yes.
But then you talk to another ethicist who is not a Christian, and you might say, well, actually, wait a minute, there is a disagreement here. And in those cases, it will be interesting to compare different points of view within that field of expertise and say, oh, well, that's interesting that if the expert has a particular background, he's going to tell me X, and if he has a different background, he's going to tell me Y. You need to be aware of the fact that even experts can have biases, of course. Goes, you know, because they're human beings. That goes for scientists as well. We all have biases. What makes science different from other sort of ways of knowing, so to speak,
is that ultimately,
right? It's an epistemological question. Ultimately, scientists have to collide with nature, with reality. You know, so you can have all the biases that you want, you can have all of the ideas that you want, but when you're going to do the experiment, either it's going to work or it's not going to work. You can think, for instance, that you can fly out of the window and go up. But if you try it, you're going to fall down and smash yourself on the pavement, right? So you can talk to people and say, no, I'm really able to fly. But ultimately, the question is, well, open the window and jump. We'll see what happens, right? And we know what's going to happen.
Yes. So
regardless of what your biases might be or your ideology might be, we know exactly what's going to happen.
Yes, absolutely. So let's shift in here to politics, because this is a super interesting question to me, because it baffles my mind, and it's a very complex question as to, you know, when we're looking at America right now and the mask mandates and the COVID vaccines and the theories and conspiracy theories surrounding this, what seems to me is there is a conflation of scientific knowing and political knowing or ideological knowing, just like what you just said. How do you think we can tell the difference between those things, specifically politically, and separate those?
Well, they're difficult to separate for a couple of reasons. First of all, if science has to be useful, it has to inform policy.
Right.
So there is
Which is politics.
Which is, of course, politics, which is itself, you know, had to deal with the politics. I mean, nobody implements policies without any particular political bend or on things. So in a sense, it's kind of difficult to extricate them. It's kind of difficult to tell them apart, to separate them, because inevitably, if you want to make scientific advice practical, then you're running into policy advice, and policy advice is very near politics. Certain people will take the advice and other people won't take the advice. So that said, however, you can distinguish between the policies and the scientific advice if you pay a little bit of attention, right? So, for instance, let's talk about masks, which we actually know quite a bit at this point, the efficacy or not of masks.
Right.
We know quite a bit about it. So what is the scientific consensus at this point about masks? Well, the data show pretty clearly that masks do protect individuals, although to different degrees, depending on what masks you use. For instance, cloth masks are less protective than higher level surgical masks. And then there is the professional ones that are the most protective of all. Now, we even know how much, what the numbers are, right? So viral particles are filtered, 99% of viral particles, 95% of viral particles are filtered out by the very high-end masks, and only about 40 to 50% by the cloth masks, if they're worn correctly. Because if you don't wear it correctly, then all bets are off.
And so what that means is that the virus is 40, they're thinking that 40 to 50% of the viral stuff that you're breathing out
That you're breathing in. Those are protection for you. Breathing in, right. In terms of breathing out, they're almost, even the cloth masks are very close to 100% protection. Meaning
really?
That, right. Meaning that you're protecting other people, basically, quite a bit.
Gotcha. Okay.
So there's an asymmetry. Correct. Exactly. So breathing out is about protecting other people. If you use a mask when you breathe out, you're not protecting yourself, you're protecting other people. And the protection that is afforded by even the simple cloth masks is very high. Okay. It's not quite 100%, but it's very high. So on the other hand, if we're talking about protecting yourself, then a cloth mask protects you only 40, 50%. In other words, it intercepts only 40, 50% of the particles, viral particles, and then better masks protect more. Now, that's the science, right? That's the best science that is available at the moment.
Right.
Of course, as all science, that could change. We knew far less about masks, for instance, a year ago or a year and a half ago when the pandemic started, because people hadn't done that many studies about, we're not been in a pandemic for a long time, for a century. So
yes.
We didn't really have a lot to go on. But now this is the current consensus. And again, we should always understand that current consensus means literally the current majority opinion within science. That could change. Right, new data may come in, and you would hope that if new data comes in, the scientists do change their mind. You don't want people to be stuck on one thing regardless of the data that comes in. But right
yes.
now, that's the best understanding that we have. Now, then we move from the facts of science as much as science can tell you to the policy. So given that information I just gave you, and given a number of other variables, such as the infection rate of the virus in a local community, such as the fact that you may be indoor or outdoor, such as the fact that you may be vaccinated or not vaccinated, such as the fact that you may be immunotolerant or not, or immunodeficient, all of these other things enter into the equation, and that's why it gets complicated, right?
Yes.
But once you have all of that information, then the policymaker can say, okay, given all of that, my best guess is that people should wear masks, not wear masks, wear masks under these conditions, but not others, and so on and so forth. For instance, I'm here in New York City, and New York City has changed and keeps changing the policy, not only because the data changed, not only because the information comes from the science changed, but because the situation on the ground is different. Right. So, for instance, during the summer, for much of the summer, the numbers in New York were fairly low in terms
right.
of, so the percentage of people that tested positive was very low. That meant that New York did not enforce a mask mandate outdoors, or if you were vaccinated, even indoors. And that policy, to my mind, made sense, because what you have there is like, look, if you're vaccinated, you already have a fairly large percentage of protection. It varies depending on the vaccine, but you have a fairly very good protection. Not 100%. No vaccine
sure.
will protect you 100%, but you have a very high percentage. On top of which, the chances that you're meeting somebody indoor in that particular environment who actually carries the virus and is infected is very low. So balance that against the inconvenience of wearing a mask when you go to a restaurant or something like that.
Right.
And, the policymaker said, don't. You don't need to. But now the policy is changing, because the number of positive cases has increased in the meantime. So there is an increasing number of cases. So now my chances to meet somebody with a significant viral load is higher, right? And I am vaccinated, but I was vaccinated 6 months ago. And we know that vaccines start losing efficacy after 8 months.
And this is all vaccines or just this?
Right. Right now, not all vaccines. It depends on the vaccine.
Just COVID vaccines.
Yeah, COVID vaccine, even those actually vary. But the Pfizer and Moderna, which are the two major ones in the United States, start losing efficacy, according to the current data, after about 8 months. So I got another couple of months, after which I'm going to be at risk, right? Hmm. And so what am I going to do? Well, the more I approach the 8 months mark, the more I start being careful. So right now, during the summer, for instance, I traveled, you know, with masks and everything. I went to restaurants and so on and so forth. But if we're coming in the next month or the month after that, I'm going to stop traveling. I'm going to resume wearing a mask.
Until you get your booster.
Until I get my boost shot. That's right. And then things will change again. So that's the thing. It is, number one, complicated because there's a lot of variables at play. And the situation changes constantly. That's why, you know, so people complain, but, oh, but scientists change their mind. You know, one time they tell me that, this, and another time they tell me that. Well, yeah, because the situation changes.
The data
what
changes.
Do you want? Would you prefer somebody to give you exactly the same advice regardless of what the situation is? That doesn't
No, we don't want that. Right.
Now, of course, there is also mistakes. There is also exaggerations. There are people that go on television and make claims that are actually not substantiated by the best science. The best science now is much, much better than it was a year ago. So, you know, all of that enters into decisions at the level of policymaking. And that's why there is no, you know, simple, obvious answer, straightforward answer to, you know, should I do this or should we do that? Well, it depends. It depends on what the situation is.
No, that makes a lot of sense. One thing I was wanting to ask you is because of your interaction with gene and environment, and this is going to be a silly question, but I think you'll understand the heart behind it, but I'm going to ask it in a silly way. Is there a Republican gene or a Democrat gene?
It's a good question. And actually, believe it or not, some people have looked into it. The straightforward answer, the simple answer is no. Human behaviors are too complicated for that sort of stuff. Now, that said, there is actually research that shows that some people seem to be at an innate level more prone to authoritarianism.
Really?
So, yes. And others are more rebellious, more, you know, now let me do whatever the hell I want kind of thing. However, even that, so there is some research that actually shows that there may be a genetic component to that sort of stuff. But even so, my research of 20 plus years in gene environment interaction shows that almost any complex character, especially behavioral traits, it's always a complex combination of genes and environments. And let me give you an example. So,
please.
For instance, we often hear that there are people who are who have an innate talent, like, you know, kids that at 5 years old start playing piano and they're you know, very, very good and that sort of stuff, right? Now, those things are real. There are actually, you know, very, very precocious talents. However, no matter how precocious that talent is, it can be improved by practice, by in other words, by the environment. And in fact, even if you know nothing about music and you have no talent whatsoever, you can still learn to play an instrument by practicing. In other words, the environment does make a difference. So regardless of what your genetic base is, you know, are you genetically a Mozart or are you genetically incompetent from a musical perspective? Well, whatever you are, but you can improve by practicing.
Right.
And that's true for both Mozart and somebody who doesn't have any idea of what, you know, of what music and sound should be like. And because we cannot change the genetics, but we can change the environment, then I think the focus for our, as far as our policies are concerned, should be the environment, not the genes. The genes are what they are. You know, you're born with certain genetic makeup and that's it. You're not going to change, at least not for now.
Right.
you know, people, some people are working on genetic engineering, but right now you can't do that. Not in any way. If right now genetic engineering at that level is basically science fiction still. It may turn out to be science reality in some, at some point in the future. But right now, you are born with the genes you have, and that's it. You're stuck with those. However, that doesn't mean you are fated to do things in a certain way. It doesn't mean that things are going to happen in a certain way. Let me give you two examples. One is in my family. My wife has an identical twin. And you would think, so those, by definition, those are two people who have exactly the same genes. They are very different from each other. They look the same. They look very similar, absolutely. But their life trajectory, their personalities, their life trajectories, what they've done with their lives is completely different. Completely. They have absolutely nothing to do with each other, which means that the environment has a major role to play, of course, despite the fact that the genes are identical. Another example that might be that your listeners might be familiar with, or at least they can check very easily. So if you get a can of soda, like Coke or Pepsi or something like that, and you read the ingredients, right, there is a warning that says there that you shouldn't drink that stuff if you are a phenylketonuric. Phenylketonuric, right, is somebody who has a genetic defect. They cannot make an enzyme, phenylalanine, that digests, therefore, that, you know, that digests certain components that are inside the Coke, as well as a bunch of other, you know, foods. Now, if you're phenylketonuric, if you have the defective gene, there is nothing you can do about changing that.
Right.
And if you're not, and phenylketonurics can actually develop, if they assimilate a lot of phenylalanine, they can actually develop severe mental retardation. They can be really seriously developmentally hampered in terms of brain development and stuff like that. And yet, there are millions of people in the world who are phenylketonuric and are perfectly normal people. They're just like you and me. How did they manage that? They just didn't drink Coke. They didn't have, you know, they stayed away with their on their diet. They stayed away from phenylalanine because they cannot process it, and that's it.
Right.
End of story. So now you have a genetic disease that has been basically defeated by a simple change in the environment. Just don't drink the stuff.
Right.
Eat some, you know, drink something else. Eat something else. Just not that one, because that's going to kill you, or that's going to cause serious issues. So genetics is not a it's not something that cannot be altered. You know, it doesn't determine your fate. It only poses certain constraints on what you can do or cannot do. You know, if you are phenylketonuric, you cannot drink Coke,
right?
Because otherwise, you're going to be in trouble. But you know, there is a lot more to life than drinking Coke, so you can do other things and be perfectly fine.
So. Let me ask you a question, just thinking about the Democrat and Republican, and then even thinking about, of course, the environmental factors behind faith, because politics are ideologically informed and faith is ideologically informed. It's about basic beliefs, right? So if we're thinking about those, like the interaction of those two things, what do you think, from your understanding of philosophy and science, how do people change their minds? Like, well, what is it that? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. There is a lot of research on that, actually, done usually by social psychologists and, you know, people like that. And so we know quite a bit about how people change their minds about things, and there are basically two. I'm simplifying, but there are two major ways in which people change their mind. One is as a result of catastrophic and traumatic events. Right, so we are coming up tomorrow on the anniversary of 9/11, for instance. And, you know, a lot of people either embraced faith or, in fact, lost their faith on that day or the day after, you know, or shortly thereafter. Why? Because they're suddenly presented with a macroscopic event, a major thing that they not expect, that it's traumatic, and they have to cope with it one way or another. So one way in which people change their beliefs either politically, for instance, or religiously, is as a result of a traumatic event. Doesn't have to be something as traumatic as 9/11. It could be simply your mother dying,
right,
or your child dying, even worse,
right.
You know, again, people react in either one of those two ways. They either embrace religion or, in fact, abandon religion as a result of traumatic events. The other major way in which people change their mind is very slowly, over a period of months or years, and as a result of multiple exposure to different perspectives. So, for instance, I mean, think about back to your own life, and you know, try to think about the times you change your mind about some major issue.
Right.
I actually have a blog where from time to time I publish an entry that says, okay, I changed my mind about this. Right? So I kind of have a record about major
That's
things.
Cool.
I mean, not minor things like, you know, do I prefer chocolate ice cream or
yes.
vanilla ice cream?
Hey, that could be major.
That could be major. I don't know. I have no idea why anybody would not prefer chocolate. But anyway, major things. So it happens. You know, people change their mind about all
yes.
sorts of things. Now, if you pay attention to how that happens, I cannot think of a single case, maybe very rarely, where I'm having a discussion with somebody, let's say a friend or a colleague or something, and then all of a sudden in the middle of a conversation, I say, you know what? You're right. I just changed my mind. You just convinced me. That doesn't happen for a number of reasons. Number one, because typically we don't like to say that we're wrong. And so
yeah.
there is a kind of a tendency to say,
yeah,
I want to save face. But also, number two, because if it is really, if we're talking about something important, such as your political allegiance or your religious ideology or, you know, anything that is major, that you really feel strong about it. Well, first of all, you feel strong about it. And second of all, you've thought about it for a long time.
Yes.
So, of course, you're not going to change your mind on the spot just because somebody brings up an argument that is, you know. However, what happens, at least again in my case, and it turns out in the literature in social psychology sort of backs this up. It's like, so let's say I have a conversation with a friend and the friend makes some points that I don't have an answer for, right, on the spot. But I ignore them on the spot. And then I later on, like maybe a week later or a month later, find, yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about that.
Yes.
And then probably I'll just set it aside. But then another conversation happens with somebody else, you know, a couple months later, and somebody else makes similar points. And crap, this again.
And then the right. connection comes.
And eventually the connection comes and he said, well, you know what? I might actually have been wrong about this particular thing, or, you know, you change your mind. So this research shows that people do change their mind, but it takes time. It takes multiple exposures. Usually you don't change your mind on the spot just because somebody told you something. And ideally, that multiple exposure is from different sources. That is, it's not that just because you go to the same person over and over and the same person tells you the same thing over and over that you're going to change your mind. Hmm. You're going to go to this person, and then you hear from that, and then you read something else, or then you watch something on television, and then you hear on the radio, and so on and so forth. And at some point, something clicks and says, all right, I think I now think differently about that stuff.
So what you're saying is my post online isn't changing people's minds that disagree with me.
Not on the
article
spot.
I posted. Not on
not
the
on
spot.
Not on the spot. Not on the spot. I mean, you know, as I said, when I was in Tennessee, I occasionally debated creationists because that was the thing to do there. I wouldn't recommend it, by the way, because debates are, you know, not a particularly good format for discussing ideas. But nevertheless.
Right.
I knew that I wasn't going to change anybody's mind on the spot. But years later, I still get emails or letters from people that say, you know, I was at that debate you did like 20 years ago, and I certainly didn't believe what you were saying in the moment. But you kind of made me start thinking about stuff. And then, you know, a few years later, I actually did change my mind.
Wow.
That's amazing. But
it is.
You know, you're very rarely going to see the results of that. That sort of stuff. I tell you one thing that happens, however, that is useful. And this is an experience that I just had literally like 2 days ago. So on my blog, I published something and somebody disagreed vehemently. So they just like their first post was like, their first comment was like, on my nose. It's like, oh, I can't believe you're writing this kind of thing. And okay. So usually when that kind of stuff happens, I do one or two things. Either I ignore it because I'm not bound to answer everybody's comments. And I just, don't have the time. Or as in this particular case, I say, well, okay, let's talk about this. So why do you think that? Right. So instead of answering, oh, you're an idiot. You know, why are you so stupid that you don't get what I just wrote? I said, well, let's talk about it. Let's think. You know, two exchanges later, the guy said, I don't think we're that far from each other in terms of positions. And I appreciate the fact that you managed to turn a confrontational, something that started out as a confrontation, into an actual conversation. So it does work, but it takes time and effort, and you may not be able to see the results. Because you know, you may convince somebody, but they are not going to write to you, and therefore you'll never know.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So following on that, and this is kind of there's a practical question at the end, but this is our last big question. So we have a variety of listeners: Christians, atheists, Muslims, Hindus, people that are from the left and the right politically in America. What do you think, in your experience and your understanding, what do you want to say to them, to say to our listeners about how to interact with each other on these topics?
I would answer the way in which Aristotle actually answered that kind of question, like 2200 years ago. So Aristotle wrote an important book on rhetoric. And rhetoric is the art of persuasion, right? Essentially. It's how do you change people's mind? How do you interact with people? And Aristotle said, well, if you want to interact positively with people, if you want to give them a chance to change your mind and maybe agree with what you're saying, you have to have three things that you keep in mind in the way you interact with people. He called them the logos, the pathos, and the ethos. These are the Greek words. But the logos means you have to have good reasons and good facts on your side. So make sure you do your homework.
Right.
Make sure that if somebody says, well, how do you know that? You have an answer. Because if you don't have an answer, you lost people right there. It's like, okay, this guy is full of crap. He's just making things up.
Unless they agree with you. And then they're like,
Right. So have the logos ready there. You have to have your good arguments. But good arguments by themselves are not going to convince many people. What you also need is the ethos. Ethos is basically a reputation. It's like people have to trust you. And so you have to work on a human level to show people that you are actually a nice guy, that you're actually trustworthy, right? I still remember after one of my debates with a creationist, somebody came up to me and said, you know, I don't believe what you were, putting forth during the debate, but I have to say, you seem like a really nice guy. Okay, that's progress. Because if you see the other person as evil, as the enemy, as misguided, as stupid, and so on and so forth, that's the end of a discussion. You're not gonna go anywhere. So that's the second component, the ethos. You have to make sure that people understand you're just like them, you're a human being, and you're doing your best. And the third is the pathos. Pathos means emotional involvement. You have to make sure that other people understand that this thing, whatever it is you're talking about, actually matters. And it matters to them. So, for instance, if we were having a conversation about COVID and, should you get vaccinated or not, should you use masks or not, and so on and so forth. One thing you might want to bring up is like, well, are you concerned about your kids getting the virus? Are you?
Yeah.
Everybody's concerned about their kids. So it's like, it matters to you. It's not just, it's this abstract thing that happens and you have nothing to do with it. You are the one that might end up in the ICU, or your kids might end up in the ICU. So surely that matters. Now, just because you care about your kids, of course, it doesn't mean you're going to buy my position on it. But if you put those three things together, right? So you have a good argument, you showed that you actually are a reasonable person and you're interested, you want to do the right thing, and you point out that these things actually matter. Well, now we got something. Now we can actually have a conversation, right? And we can go somewhere. Otherwise, you know, if you rely on only one of those three things, Aristotle says, don't waste your time.
Those are such wise words. What projects are you working right now that you want to let the listeners know about?
I'm working actually I'm almost finished with a new book that looks at the relationship between politics and philosophy.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can have a conversation about this next year when the book comes out. So it starts out, the book starts out with a famous dialogue between Socrates, you know, arguably the most famous philosopher in the Western tradition,
right,
and Alcibiades. Alcibiades was a young Athenian who was brilliant, you know, handsome, rich. I mean, he had everything, basically.
Right.
And he happened to be also a student of Socrates and a friend of Socrates. And Alcibiades wanted to go into politics, which he did eventually, and wanted to shape the world and wanted to, you know, shape Athens, the future of Athens, which he did. Unfortunately, not for the best, but it eventually did. And so they're having this conversation, and Socrates at some point says, you know, my friend, the problem with you and a lot of people like you is that you want to do a lot of things, but you literally have no idea what you're talking about. And so you're going to go into politics without actually having done the proper homework, without actually knowing what you're doing, and you're going to create a catastrophe. You're going to cause a catastrophe. And sure enough, Socrates was right. Alcibiades was single-handedly responsible for half of the losses of Athens during the Peloponnesian War. So it's like it was a disaster. So I take that episode as a starting point for a conversation in the book between philosophy and politics, asking the question of how much our policy making should be informed by understanding of philosophy, ethics, you know, et cetera. So it's been a lot of fun to work on it, and it's almost done.
Well, that is so awesome. Thank you so much for being on, Massimo. And this has been Massimo Piliucci. And thank you for being here. Such a great conversation. I wish we could go longer, but our time is at an end. So thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Right, guys. Well, we will be back next week. We'll see you then. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Have a great day. Bye.